Okay, so welcome to night number last session. In this session, we are talking about that third step in this process. Any worldview must be able to explain three things. It must be able to explain the origin of matter, stuff. You got to start with stuff. And then that matter has to come to life. So how do you get life? That's what we dealt with yesterday and this morning. And now I want to talk about complex life, so to speak. So that's going to be the first half. And then the second half, we're going to finish off with a necessary conclusion. In fact, the conclusion is probably my favorite part because that's where the rubber meets the road. And you'll see what that is when we get there. So welcome to God or Goo, a biblical and scientific investigation of our past. We're answering this question, where did all of this stuff come from? All of the galaxies, all of the molecules, the DNA, the information, where did it all come from? And as you know, there are really two options. There is the biblical worldview. Still having an issue here. Let's give this another go. If we change the battery and it works, then we have some explaining to do. Okay. Let's go with that, see how it goes. There's in the beginning God, that's the biblical worldview. And this comes straight from, surprise, the Bible. So you go to the very first verse of the Bible and it starts off unashamedly, in the beginning God created. You keep reading and it talks about how he did this in 6 days. You do the math, there are dates in the Bible. You do the math and it comes out to be about 6,000 years ago. That's what we call the biblical worldview. But that's not the only idea out there. As you know, there's in the beginning goo, the idea that everything arose by purely natural causes. We're calling this the evolutionary worldview. So the whole point of this four sessions is to demonstrate one thing really, and only one thing, that it's not faith on the side of the Christians, science on the side of the evolutionists. It is faith versus faith. So these scientists are using faith to explain their origins, just like we use faith to explain our origins. In particular, we've looked at cosmic evolution. Organic evolution is what we looked at this morning. And in this session, we are going to be looking at Darwinian evolution, or so to speak, the last step in this process. Do you remember, we're going to call this chutes or ladders. Chutes or ladders. You'll see why in just a moment. This all started out yesterday with this question. How many here were here yesterday and answered this question? Okay, remember we were going through this quiz. You had to answer yes or no, yes or no, yes or no. And this was the last question in the quiz. So I want to come back to this. This is not about aliens, so don't jump off on that track. This is just to demonstrate that words have multiple meanings, right? So if somebody says, do you believe in aliens? We usually think of like the green guys flying around in spaceships. But alien just means somebody who's a citizen of another country other than the one that they're in. So words have different meanings. So if somebody asks this, you might want to ask, what do you mean by aliens? The same thing is true of that word evolution. When someone says, do you believe in evolution, this is usually what we think about, right? This the goo to you idea, the bacteria to blue whales, that type of thing. So that's what we think about. But you might want to ask, what do you mean by evolution? Because a lot of people define it different ways. There's parts of evolution that's true. Don't let that surprise you. I'm going to show you that, and you're going to see it and be like, oh, okay. I don't consider that evolution. That's what you'll say. You'll see that here in just a moment. But then there's part of it which you've been seeing all along that is unscientific, completely unscientific. And so when someone asks you this question, you might want to ask, what do you mean by evolution? This is critical for really understanding this in a correct perspective. So let's dive in. Chutes or ladders. I'm going to give you the punchline right here at the beginning. How many of you have played the game Chutes and Ladders? Chutes and Ladders. It's a classic. You start down here at the bottom, and if you're lucky enough and you roll, you can either climb up ladders and get higher up. You got to get up here to 100. Or if you're unlucky, you might land on a slide or a chute and you go down. So the point is, whether you're a creationist, you believe the Bible, or you're an evolutionist, you don't believe the Bible, we all believe in change over time. What's another word for change over time? Evolution. You know, in a very basic definition. We all believe in some sort of change over time. Here's the key difference. As biblical creationists, we believe God created everything perfect. And it's been changing ever since creation shoots all the way down. It's been losing its perfection and the changes that we see. Cancer. Do you think cancer existed in the original creation? No. Cancer is a genetic problem when our cells don't work the way they're supposed to. That's a change that has arisen since creation. So things are changing. We just believe it started good and they're changing for the worse. Evolution is the exact opposite. They believe it started down here and it's changing for the better. So I'll kind of clarify this as we go through it. This is the key distinction to understanding evolution. So here we go. There are all sorts of creatures out there. We've got tree frogs, tarantulas, more tree frogs, lions, whales, red-tailed hawks, all sorts of critters. Where did all of these things come from? That's sort of what we're answering today. Where did all this stuff come from? Well, from the biblical worldview, if you open up the Bible, you're going to see right out of the gates, the Bible says, and God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. So according to the Bible, God created life. That simple. Here's another verse. And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beasts of the earth after his kind. And it was so. God created life. But if you're stuck with a worldview that says no God allowed, then where did all of this stuff come from? And you've been around the block a few times. You know what they would say. It would look something like this. Right? How many of you have seen something like this before in your life? Right? So this morning we talked about how do you get the goo? And we found out that is statistically impossible. You can't do that. Today we're looking at where did the rest of this stuff come from? Now in the evolutionary worldview, they would say this came as a result of Darwinian evolution. So let's talk about that guy, Darwin. So Darwin, he's a household name now. We all know him. He was famous, and let's give credit where credit is due. He was an excellent observer. He was an excellent note taker. He went as a young man on this voyage on the HMS Beagle, and he, from 1831 to 1836, traveled all over the world collecting data about the things that he saw, the creatures that he saw. And then he went home to England. This is his house just outside of London. And here's his study. And he began to just go over his notes, and he came up with this book, which we've all heard of before, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. So what Darwin is doing, he went to sit down, and he was asking this question. Where did all of this variety come from? Where did all these different species come from? All the different species of birds and all the species of finches. And he wrote the book to try to explain this. So we're going to look a little bit about what he said. But first of all, what does that word species mean? The origin of species. I'm going to show an example of this. Species is just a man-made way that we try to organize information. So up here at the top, we have our largest grouping, and we call this a domain. And then inside of the domain, we have a smaller grouping, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So there are several species in a genus, there are several genera in a family, there are several families in an order, several orders in a class, and so on and so forth. All right, it gets complicated. Okay. But I want to show an example of, let's take a wild horse. So a wild horse, it is in domain Eukarya. That's where scientists have, they classify it. It's in kingdom Animalia. It's in phylum Chordata. It's in class Mammalia. That kind of sounds familiar, right? Mammals. It's in order Perissodactyla. It's in family Equidae. Genus Equus. Species Ferus. And I'll be quizzing on you on that afterwards, okay? So that's how we would scientifically classify this horse species. Now, there are other types of horses out there too, aren't there? There are actually 7 horse species. Such as, I'm not showing all 7 here. Here's the wild horse. Zebras. Those are kind of like a horse, right? What about donkeys? So you notice these are all part of the same genus, Equus. Probably hard to read it way in the back. These are all part of the same genus, Equus, but they're all different species. So here's a little thought question for you. Do you suppose that when God created horses, he created all of these different species? It's an interesting question, right? Did he create all of these different species? Well, let's see what he says in the Bible. I want you to read the yellow words. I'll read everything else. Are you ready? Here we go. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit." All right. Interesting phrase. Let's keep going. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed. And the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself. And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly. And every winged fowl. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth." And God made the beast of the earth and cattle and everything that creepeth upon the earth. And God saw that it was good. You noticing a phrase kind of showing up pretty frequently? So it says when God created organisms, he created them to reproduce after their kind. So if they can reproduce, then evidently they're part of the same kind. So we would say, as creationists, that God created one horse kind, and within that horse, he gave them the variability to be able to produce all the variety that you see up on the screen. All of those different species within that one horse kind. Did you know you can take a boy zebra and a girl donkey, and they can produce offspring? It's called, I'm not joking, by the way, it's called a zonkey. That's completely true. You can go the other way. You can cross a horse to a donkey and you get a mule. So all of these different horses can interbreed. So we would say they're all part of the same kind. God didn't create all of the different species. He created the horse kind, and they had the variability to produce the species. We believe in change, don't we? Okay, here's another fun example. The panther kind. We've got leopards, Panthera burchelli, tigers, Panthera tigris, lions, Panthera leo. Do you think God created all of these individually, or do you think he created one cat kind with the variability to be able to create these variations? Well, one way to find out is let's see if they can interbreed. Did you know that everything up here on this screen can interbreed? It's kind of crazy. Now, they don't typically do it in the wild. Let's be honest. There are some size issues. But you can take a lion, cross it with a tiger, and you will get a liger. I kid you not. You can take a leopard, cross it with a lion, and you will get a... Anyone want to guess? A leopin. Yes. So evidently God created all of these to be able to interbreed. He created one cat kind, and within that cat kind, the ability to produce these different varieties. So we believe in this change. And this is an observable, these types of small variations are observable scientific changes. But you will never get a kangarion or a zino. Or a spog, a sparrow and a dog. Now, obviously, there are some barriers, some limitations to what these things are able to do. Perfect example. Anybody here have a dog? All right. And I think, if I understood correctly, the Stevens are interested in getting a dog if the opportunity arises. Maybe I got that wrong. I'm not sure. So There are a ton of variety in the songs, right? Do you think God created chihuahuas? Let's be serious here, right? Who would create a chihuahua? No, God didn't create chihuahuas. He didn't create Great Danes. He created a dog. And that dog, through just breeding, we have selectively bred all of these different breeds from those dogs. From the little tiny ones to giant ones. Look at all of that variety that God built into his creation. This is change, though, isn't it? It is change, but it's just a different type of change. So things do change over time. All dogs descended from wolves. This is observable, demonstrable. You could take wolves starting from scratch and breed all the dog species. Just you would die before you got them all. So is there anybody in here who's our youngest person in here? It might be Eva. Who? How old are you? 8. Okay. Anybody younger than 8? All right, we're going to go with this. So now, this isn't rocket science. It's pretty easy to tell which things are part of the same kind and which things aren't. What's your name? All right, Lillian. Okay, Lillian, I have a question for you. Are you ready? Look up here on the screen. I'm going to show you 4 things. I want you to tell me which one is not like the others. Okay? We've got a dog, a wolf, a coyote, and a banana. Lillian, which one of these is not like the others? Okay, all right. Very good. That's a little facetious. But don't you see how the dog kind, not only did dogs come from wolves, but probably dogs, wolves, coyotes all came from the original dog kind. Through variation that God built into that kind. So, Charles Darwin actually saw this same thing. And that's what inspired him. So a lot of what he says in the book, if you were to read it, it's really dense reading, but a lot of the reading back then was. If you were to read it, a lot of what he says in the book makes perfect sense. And then you'll see him make a leap of faith. Okay, so let me show you, for example. One of the things he saw was all of these finches. You remember probably seeing a picture like this in a book at some point. Darwin's finches. Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands. He saw all these finches. He saw all the variation in their beaks. And he said, all of these finches probably came from a common ancestor, which was a finch. We agree with that. That's change, though, right? It is change, but that's little change. So we're going to call that little change. Here's another quote from his book. In regards to ducks and rabbits, I do not doubt that they all have descended from the common wild duck and rabbit. What do you think? Do you think that's a valid statement? All the different breeds of ducks, they probably had a common ancestor and it was a duck. All the different breeds of rabbits, they probably had a common ancestor and it was a rabbit. That's no problem. That's little change. That's observable. We see that in breeding cattle, breeding dogs. All right, now here's the big jump. Are you ready? Therefore, I should infer from analogy that probably all the organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from some one primordial form. Now he's just jumped into the arena of faith, the unproven and the unprovable. Now we're talking about big change. Big change like that. Now, we'll come back to that in just a minute. That's why when you open up Discovery Magazine, you're going to find things like this. Was your ancestor a sponge? This is your ancestor. Now, there's a few differences between you and a sponge. There's a lot of new information that you have that a sponge does not have. So all of that had to come from someplace. So when somebody asks, do you believe in evolution, you might want to ask, are you talking about the big change that Darwin was just hypothesizing about? Or are you talking about the little change that we see every day all around us? What do you mean by evolution? I'm going to show you some examples of this. So let's distinguish these two, little change from the big change. So in little change, we call this variation within a kind. This is like the dogs, wolves, coyotes. The big change is the theory of common descent, that everything came from some goo. The little changes, dog, wolf, coyotes, big changes, bacteria to blue whales. The little change is scientific. It's observable. We see this happening all the time. The big change is unscientific. It's never been observed. But most importantly, and here's the crux of the matter, it's not the size of the change that's important. It's the direction of the change. So we believe God created everything perfect, i.e. gray wolves. And they've been going downhill ever since, i.e. chihuahuas. whereas evolution would say that everything has been increasing in information ever since then. For instance, I'm sticking with the dog example. It's a very understandable example. This is from National Geographic. Wolf to wolf. And notice what they call it. The evolution of dogs. I'm sorry, the red is kind of not showing up well. That's okay. I'm going to just tell you what's there. They call it the evolution of dogs. Now, we wouldn't call that evolution, would we? We would call it like variation. But that's why you have to ask, what do you mean by evolution? Still a dog. That's just variation within a kind. You can, and we've said this before, you can take a wolf and you can breed all of the breeds of dogs, but you could not take a chihuahua and breed backwards and get a wolf because information has been lost along the way. That's the difference between chutes and ladders. So the biggest difference between the little change and the big change is little change requires no new information. The big change requires lots and lots of new information. The problem is, and this is what's so confusing, especially to kids in school, both of these are called evolution. Both the little change and the big change is called evolution. Now, we might disagree with the use of that term evolution for both of these, but it is what it is. That's why I always ask, what do you mean by evolution? So I'm going to show you an example from a textbook. This is a high school science textbook. And notice right here, they say evolution in action. Perfect, right? Let's see some examples of evolution in action. And they share three examples. Since Darwin published his book, scientists have observed many examples of evolution in action. So I'd really like to see one kind of animal turn into another kind of animal. That's what I would like to see when they show this. Let's see what examples they have. Okay, first example up, the finches. Is that big change or little change? That's little change. Okay, so we want to see examples of evolution, and they're showing us an example of the little change. It's still a finch. Okay, let's look at the next example. These are the three examples they provide in the book to demonstrate evolution. Example number two, peppered moths in England before and after the Industrial Revolution. So, anybody ever heard of the peppered moth story? I expect there are some people out there who have. So here's what happened. Do you see two moths up here in that picture? There are two. One of them stands out a little bit more. The black one stands out a little bit more. The white one blends in with the lichen that's on the trees. So before the Industrial Revolution in England, there was lichen on the trees, and the white moths were more prevalent than the black moths because they could blend in better and survive better. After the Industrial Revolution, the lichen was died off on the trees, so the trees turned black. And the black moths survived better, so there were more black moths around than white moths. Is that evolution? So they would call it evolution. And that's why this is so tricky, right? This is just little change. It's still a moth. And a lot of times we spend our time attacking like the story. Like, oh, well, they actually glued the moths to that tree to get that picture. And that's true in some cases. But who cares, right? It's a moth. That's not evolution. That's little change. This was example number three that they provided in the book. It was a new one to me that I had not seen. So they told a story about the squirrels at the Grand Canyon. So there are squirrels that live at the Grand Canyon. And this is called the Abert's squirrel. And it lives on one side of the Grand Canyon. And Sometime in the past, a population of the Abert squirrels got separated from the rest of the group. And that population began to change. It was separated on the other side of the canyon. And here's what it changed into. You ready for this? A squirrel. It's called the Kaibab squirrel. And you almost can't even tell the difference. This one over here is a little darker. But when the book, this is for high school students, they're saying, I'm going to show you examples of evolution in action. This is real life evolution. And they show three examples of little change. It's still a squirrel. Okay, why is that such a big problem? Because it's kind of like a bait and switch technique. They're going to tell you, hey, I'm going to show you evolution in action. They show you a bunch of examples that we all agree with, right? Those are changes. That's just not the big change evolution. This is little change variation within a kind. The problem is with the big change, in order to get big change like this, you need lots and lots of new information. The original goo didn't have an eyeball. So somewhere along the way, we needed the genes, the DNA, to create an eyeball inserted in there. Where did all that new information come from? Not just eyeballs. We have eyeballs. Photosynthesis. Think about all of the proteins, all of the DNA, all of the genes that are required for a plant to undergo photosynthesis. Where did all that information come from? Think about bombardier beetles with this interesting cannon that they fire out of their rear end with toxic chemicals. Where did all that information come from? Think about echolocation in bats. Where did all of that information come from? Think about one of my personal favorites, the silk from spiderwebs. Do you realize the silk is made from proteins? Remember, proteins are like everything. They do all the work for an animal. They're made from liquids that are squirted out of the spider's rear end. They're squirted out as liquid, and they harden into something that is stronger than steel by weight. That's new information that the goo didn't have. Where did that information come from? This is the eternal problem with evolution. Lots and lots of new information. Feathers on birds, something new. Where did that information for the feather come from? And probably my all-time personal favorite, maybe not, placental development. We have six kids, number seven on the way. And as humans, babies develop with a placenta. So that means they are getting their oxygen from their mom until the point of birth. And at the point of birth, their blood flow has to get rerouted. Instead of through the umbilical cord, it gets rerouted to go through their lungs. This all happens within a couple of minutes at the point of birth, completely rerouting their blood flow. Imagine all of the information that had to be in place the very first time a baby developed through a placenta. Incredible. Okay. But I'm going to just show one example. Lots and lots of new information. This one is simple and profound. This is a little machine that is on bacteria. Where did this little machine come from? It's called the bacterial flagellum. This machine spins up to 100,000 RPM. So that's about 60 RPM. Now imagine 100,000 RPM. It's an incredibly fast machine, and it propels the bacteria through their home, their liquid medium. A fast bacteria can swim 50 times its body length in 1 second. Now, a bacteria is not very big, so that's not super long, but for the bacteria, that's really fast. Some scientists believe this is the most efficient machine known. It's an incredible machine. See if you recognize some of these parts. There's a stator, there's a rotor, there's a drive shaft. There's a bushing, there's a propeller. Sounds kind of like a motor, doesn't it? Here's what they look like in real life. I'm going to show you the picture. Ready? That is an electron microscopy image. So an electron microscope took that image. These are so tiny, you can't see them with a regular light microscope. So an electron microscope took that image. Isn't that beautiful? That order, that design. Now, it turns out that nearly 40 proteins, remember, proteins are the Legos of nature, nearly 40 proteins are required to build one of these. That means 40 proteins all had to be together in the same place at the same time to make the first flagellum. If you only had 30, no good. The flagellum doesn't work. If you had 35, it's no good. The flagellum doesn't work. You need 40. So where did all this complex design come from? Darwin said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. I've got one. The bacterial flagellum. But you're going to see examples of this all over in nature, of these complex systems that require enormous information to all be present the first time that system is used. So, you're welcome to believe in Darwinian evolution. People do. The majority of scientists do. I just don't have enough faith to believe in Darwinian evolution. And that brings us to our conclusion. Let's see how we're doing for time. Okay. Not bad. So where did all this come from? Well, if you turn to the very first verse of the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible, in the beginning, God created. God created the eye. God created the placenta. God created the bacterial flagellum. God created the feathers. God created the photosynthesis. God created the echolocation. God created all of this information, all of these amazing structures, and He should receive the glory for it. So for this last part, we've been asking this question, where did all of this come from? I want to change that question. I want to ask a slightly different question. Why does it matter? Or let's ask a slightly more unbiased question. Does it matter? Does it matter? I mean, I think it's fun. I think it's pretty interesting, but does it matter? To answer this question, I'm going to take you on a trip. We're going to go back in time. So step into your time machine. We're going to go back to the Bronx Zoo. The Bronx Zoo in New York. The year is 1906. If you went to the Bronx Zoo in 1906, you would walk in and you would see the monkey house. That looked pretty neat. If you head inside the monkey house, you would see a human being in the monkey cage. His name was Odo Banga. You would see this sign. The African pygmy, Odo Banga, age 23 years, height 4 feet 11 inches, weight 103 pounds, brought from the Kasai River, Congo Free State, South Central Africa by Samuel P. Werner, exhibited each afternoon during September. So I want to ask you a question. How does a human being end up in a cage? It has to do with your worldview. You see, what you believe about the past affects what you believe about the present and the future. Don't take my word for it. This guy, William Provine, he was at Cornell University and retired just before I got there. I never actually met this fella. He died recently. And here's what he says. Let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. There are no gods, no purposes, no goal-directed forces of any kind. There is no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I am going to be dead. That's the end for me. There is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning to life, and no free will for humans either. After all, we are just bags of chemicals. In the evolutionary worldview, we're just bags of chemicals trying to pass on our DNA. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. This is Darwin's book. Did you know it has a subtitle to this book? And it says, I'll just read it to you. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That's the subtitle for Darwin's book, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Here's what Darwin says. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of higher animals, that's us, directly follows. So in Darwin's worldview, war, famine, death, these are the good guys. This is what brought us into the world. What is, in the Christian worldview, what is the highest moral value, would you say? I'll take a raised hand. Think about it first. What is the highest moral value in the Christian worldview? In the back. Love. I would agree. Love. Love is self-sacrifice for the good of somebody else. Now, in the Darwinian worldview, what is the highest moral value? Survival of the fittest. That's what it all boils down to. Survival of the fittest. There it is. The preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. That's the subtitle of Darwin's book. Now you can probably see where this is going. This is Darwin. At some point, at some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace throughout the world the savage races. The break will then be rendered wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state and some ape as low as a baboon, instead of, as at present, between the Negro or the Australian and the gorilla. So from a Darwinian perspective, we are all just animals. Some people are more like animals in the Darwinian worldview. Now you can see why somebody would end up in a zoo, a human being in a zoo. And this was not the run-of-the-mill people who threw this guy in the zoo. This was the Harvards, the Cornells, the Princetons, the Yales that put this person in a zoo. Here's the New York Times at the time. We do not quite understand all the emotion which others are expressing in the matter. It is absurd to make moan over the imagined humiliation and degradation Benga is suffering. The pygmies are very low in the human scale, and the suggestion that Benga should be in a school instead of a cage ignores the high probability that school would be a place from which he could draw no advantage whatever. The idea that men are all much alike, except as they have had or lacked opportunities for getting an education out of books, is now far out of date. Now, these are the intellectual elites of the time. This is, by the way, why you don't let the intellectual elites determine morality. That's determined in the biblical worldview by God's revelation. Now, thankfully, a couple of Baptist preachers actually stepped up and said, let's do something about this. This is Reverend James Gordon. He says, our race, we think, is depressed enough without exhibiting one of us with the apes. We think we are worthy of being considered human beings with souls. Now, Ernst Haeckel, you can think of him as Darwin 2.0. You see, he lived a little later than Darwin. He kind of took the baton and ran with it after Darwin left the scene. Here's what he had to say. Christianity makes no distinction of race or of color. It seeks to break down all racial barriers. In this respect, the hand of Christianity is against that of nature. For are not the races of mankind the evolutionary harvest which nature has toiled through long ages to produce? May we not say, then, that Christianity is anti-evolutionary in its aim? The scary thing is, from the evolutionary perspective, that statement makes perfect sense from the evolutionary worldview. This is back to Darwin. He wrote another book. He wrote a bunch of books. This one's called The Descent of Man. So he's talking about kind of human's place in this new worldview of his. We civilized men do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, and the sick. Thus, the weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. Excepting, in the case of man itself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. Isn't that crazy? But wait a second. In his worldview, that's just survival of the fittest, right? No problem with that. So you can probably see where this is going. How many of you have ever heard of the term eugenics? Eugenics. This was extremely popular in the early 1900s. The father of eugenics, the fellow who coined the term eugenics, was Francis Galton. He was the cousin of Charles Darwin. see anything unusual about that connection. So eugenics was this idea that we as humans, we can actually improve our human race by eliminating the unfit. But look what they call it. Evolution, or eugenics, is the self-direction of human evolution. That's how they viewed it. It was very popular in the early 1900s. See if you can guess who made this quote. Hordes of people are born who live, yet who have done absolutely nothing to advance the race one iota. Their lives are hopeless repetitions. Such human weeds clog up the path, drain up the energies and the resources of this little earth. We must clear the way for a better world. We must cultivate our garden. Who do you think said that? Someone like Hitler, probably, right? That's Margaret Sanger. That sounds extreme, doesn't it? In the evolutionary worldview, it's just survival of the fittest. That's all it is. Another quote from Margaret Sanger. Before eugenists and others who are laboring for racial betterment can succeed, they must first clear the way for birth control. Like the advocates of birth control, the eugenists, for instance, are seeking to assist the race toward the elimination of the unfit. Unbelievable. So these are natural ideas that stem from the evolutionary worldview. It's not extreme. It's just survival of the fittest. Now, you don't hear too much about this anymore because about eugenics. Because something happened in the 1940s where somebody took these ideas to the extreme. Hitler, I have studied with great interest the laws of several American states concerning the prevention of reproduction by people whose progeny would, in all probability, be of no value or be injurious to the racial stock. Hitler took these ideas. He actually borrowed them from many of our Ivy League institutions over here in the United States. And we know what he did. He instituted survival of the fittest on a grand scheme to the order of 6 million plus human beings killed because they were seen as less fit in his eyes. Now, this fellow here, he's an evolutionist. He made the statement, the German Führer, that's Hitler, as I have consistently maintained, is an evolutionist. He has consciously sought to make the practice of Germany conform to the theory of evolution. And it looks extreme for him to kill all those people, but in his eyes, it's just survival of the fittest. Now, I'm not saying that evolution is responsible for the Holocaust. Hitler and the wickedness of man's heart is responsible for the Holocaust. What I am saying is, if you have a worldview that tells you loud and clear there is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning to life, and no free will for humans either, that's a very dangerous road to go down. When I was in high school, my older brother, who he would always get me into things like this. Yeah, he was part of these email debates. Back then, it wasn't chat rooms and online forums. It was email group debates. And so he was in this discussion with an atheist, and he sent this atheist 10 questions, and he wanted them to answer these 10 questions. The 10th question was, do you believe there is an ultimate meaning to life? And here was her answer. Personally, I think life is empty and meaningless. After all, when you're told in your textbook that you are an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms, it does make life feel kind of empty and meaningless. So what you believe matters. What you believe about the past matters. I want to tell you some of the toxic, dangerous rhetoric that I learned from the biblical worldview. I remember as a kid growing up in church, and I learned this song in church. Just listen to these dangerous words. It went like this. We're more than just accidents without a cause. We're more than just bodies and brains. God made us on purpose. We're part of a plan. He cares and he knows us by name. that dangerous to be teaching kids that He cares, He knows us by name? So, you know, you don't need fancy graphics to understand the Bible. You don't need a fancy, expensive education to understand the Bible. But you do need a little bit of faith. See, God did not give us the Bible so that we could believe in creation. He gave us the Bible so that we would believe in salvation. You know, we're told in John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on Him should not perish, but have everlasting life." Do you believe that? That is the really critical thing. But why would God send His Son to die for us? Why do we matter? The reason you matter is because if you turn to the very first verse of the very first chapter of the very first book in the Bible, you'll see these words: "In the beginning, God created." And it's just as simple as that. So, thank you everyone for this great weekend. I hope it's been an encouragement to you and a greater appreciation for God and His creation. We will close in prayer and then turn it over.